Maine as a living laboratory for studying the environment. The Gulf of Maine is warming at a rate that's significantly higher than almost any other body of water on the planet. Researchers here in Maine, along with environmental studies students, have immediate access to the environmental laboratory that is our state. They're exploring not just the effects of climate change, but also how communities can mitigate and adapt to it. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're on the campus of Bowdoin College in Brunswick to talk with three environmental researchers about the emergence of environmental science as an academic discipline and about how the issue of climate change has become politicized. We'll also explore the way some key Maine businesses, think aquaculture and tourism, are being affected by the changing environment. And as always, we want to hear from you. Maine Calling next. First, this news. From Smith Auditorium at Bowdoin College, this is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. I'm Keith Shortall. The first Earth Day was celebrated in 1970. Tomorrow marks its 47th anniversary. Today we're going to narrow our focus from the Earth to the state that we live in, and we're going to learn why Maine is uniquely situated for those who study and observe a changing environment. My guests today have ties to Bowdoin College and to the study of the environment. Eileen Johnson is an environmental studies lecturer and program manager. Dave Carlin is an associate professor of biology and director of the Coastal Studies Center. And Matthew Klingel is an associate professor of history and environmental studies. He's also a director of the environmental studies program. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Professor Dave Carlin, we'll start with you. We said at the top of the show here that Maine is a living laboratory for ocean climate change. Why is that?
Great question, Keith. Maine isn't the only, living laboratory, of course, in the United States and the world, but I think some things that set us apart is that, well, we've got a very strong historical economic connection to our forests and oceans, for sure, that precedes Western colonization, and we have a very long coastline. We actually have 3,500 miles of coastline here in Maine. That's exciting. But that coastline is changing very rapidly, as you mentioned in the introduction. It's changing at a rate that's about 99% faster than any other place in the world. And if you just look at the water temperature, that change is about 0.23 degrees Celsius per year in the last 10 years. And so you might not think that's a big deal, but that's water temperature, which just tends to change very slowly. So as a consequence, then, there's a lot of action going on. There's a lot of movement of animals in the Gulf of Maine. Things are moving north. Things are moving to deeper water and with really strong economic impacts. So our lobster fishery is our biggest fishery now in the state. And that wasn't always the case because the lobster fishery used to be centered in New England, and now it's moved northward. And it's also bringing things like invasive species, things that are really changing the marine environment. You might have heard something about the European green crab, which is essentially re-engineering seagrass beds in the Gulf of Maine and consuming softshell clam. But also there's more bizarre things like a snotty animal called a sea squirt that's actually coating the sea bottom and basically pushing kelp forests, out of the ecosystem. So there's a lot of activity, and that, that provides really amazing opportunity for our students in understanding those changes and understanding the drivers behind those changes. So they have opportunities to test general hypotheses about climate change, but also questions that might be very specific to our community, questions that people want answers to. And we're also lucky to have two wonderful field sites in the Gulf of Maine. A 30-minute drive from here, we have the Coastal Studies Center on Harpswell Sound, which our students use actively. And if we want to go farther north, we can go to Canada. We can go to Kent Island. We can take a little bit of a fun van ride, ferry, lobster boat trip, and then dory and get to Kent Island and actually really live in an ecological Shangri-La. There's no other really word for that. And get the northern aspect of this change. So
it's a good thing to have right at your feet. On the other hand, it's something that many people would not want, this laboratory of great change.
Because of their environment.
Unfortunately, I guess we're sitting really in the ground zero of climate change. But on the other hand, that's great opportunity for us that we can study it and actually do something about it.
Eileen, Dave talked about the changing the creatures that we're seeing that have moved. Moved northward as the water has warmed. Communities, though, on land have also had to adapt or are finding ways to adapt. Can you talk about how communities go about the process of not just mitigating the effects, but really adapting to what they anticipate would be the effects of climate change?
Sure. So one of the many impacts that we're seeing with climate change in Maine is an increase in storm events. So events that were historically 100-year precipitation events, we're starting to see them in greater frequencies. We're seeing an increase in precipitation overall of about 13% since 1985. But it's the nature of these events that's really starting to have an impact. And when we think back to a storm like the Patriots Day storm in 2007 that had about $22 million worth of damages that communities faced. So one of the challenges and actually opportunities for our students is to think about in a rural state like Maine with 3,500 miles of coastline, we have a land mass where our coastal communities represent about 7% of the state, but they represent about 33% of the population and 20% of the road infrastructure, and we have an increasingly aging population. So what do? Well, we think about ways that we think we can improve infrastructure, points at which roads might get flooded and limit access for residents or access for emergency responders. And then we look at where storm events might happen and how we can help help residents prepare better. So as a couple of examples of what students have done working in partnership with the many agencies, I want to say, that work every day on these issues in Maine, had a student last year who worked in partnership with a regional planning agency and looked at modeling the impact of sea level rise above these 100 storm year events, because we actually don't know what that looks like. And what that means, it allows us towns to both say, this is where we're likely to see flood now, and where will we see it in the future. That provided data for regional planners and local officials to start thinking about what kind of investments can we make. Can we start thinking about conservation, things like green infrastructure? How do we prepare owners of homes that may be in flood zones that they might be paying flood insurance rates in the future? And at the same time, it was a real marvel. It was a marvelous experience for the student who understood the importance of taking data and visualizing it and making it accessible so that local policymakers can make decisions. That's one of several projects. And I think what we really try and do here at Bowdoin is we find these opportunities, these nexus of students who can contribute to projects, learn from environmental professionals, because in addition to the natural resources, we have the human resources of many, many environmental professionals that are have been incredible mentors for our students, and we like to create those partnerships and, as an institution, contribute to them.
Matt Klingel, what role then is environmental studies playing in the overall mix these days of a liberal arts education? Has climate change provided a boost for this discipline?
Well, before I answer that question, I first want to thank my colleagues at Bowdoin, as well as your colleagues from MPBN, for making this possible. I know it takes a lot of effort behind that. Maybe it would be good to answer that question by going back to the origin of environmental studies programs. The environmental studies program at Bowdoin was founded in 1972. And that's important because it's 2 years after Earth Day and 3 years after the Santa Barbara oil spill. The first environmental studies program at a U.S. undergraduate institution was the University of California at Santa Barbara, which was at ground zero when the UNICAL platforms burst and sent tens of thousands of gallons of oil on the shores of the Pacific, made for television images of slick birds being cleaned up by volunteers, surfers coated in goo. So in a way, climate change has sharpened student interest because it is not only a threat to the biogeophysical systems of the planet, but it's also a threat to our very existence. And I think that underscores why we have an environmental studies program at Bowdoin and not an environmental sciences program. It's important to realize that the humanities ask questions about value, about justice, about beauty, about significance, about how the past touches our lives, shapes us in the present, and points to possible futures. And so in our program, we ask our students to major in environmental studies, which is interdisciplinary. They have to take classes from across the liberal arts curriculum and then also concentrate in a standalone discipline such as philosophy or biology or economics. And even the panelists here today, David, marine biologist, Eileen, trained as an interdisciplinary social scientist with a strong natural sciences background. I'm a historian, but with training in biomedical sciences and ecology. We try to represent that to our students. In a way, I like to say, and I'm definitely tooting the horn of our own program here, but here or at peer institutions such as Colby or Bates, environmental studies is the epitome of the liberal arts because it brings everything together around these questions that concern us and concern the entire planet.
So you say now it goes beyond science and,
yes.
and it permeates these other disciplines in the humanities. A question for the whole group, though. Tomorrow there's a march for science. There's a lot of activity and discussion around Earth Day. And obviously, in the wake of the election, a lot of discussion and debate and activity around climate change. Why has climate change become such a political issue when it's so based in science?
I'll take the first stab at that. This is Matt. I think because to deal with climate change, you have to deal with consumption. You have to deal about what it is that you're putting into your car's gas tank. You have to deal with the fact that you are building a home made of plywood that may be shipped all the way from Canada's boreal forest or from the softwood forests of Chile. You're dealing with questions of food. You're dealing with questions of justice. You're dealing with questions that get at the heart of international relations. Why is it that the United States, which had the fortunate opportunity to develop when it did in the 19th century, courtesy of the rich legacies of petroleum and coal and hydropower, allowed to have a high standard of living, and then we wag our fingers at China, at India, at the developing world, and say, no, you have to leave that carbon in the ground? And it also strikes the heart of many people's livelihoods. I grew up in a rural conservative state. I grew up in Utah. My grandfather worked for the Bureau of Reclamation. We have people in our immediate social circles that worked in the coal industry. And so I think it also raises difficult questions that manifested themselves in this recent election over climate change is asking difficult questions of all of us about the energy we use, about the choices we make. And the exciting thing why it's important to study that is because of these very deep questions that intersect all of the different disciplines. And it comes down to the March on Science. Remember, the first Earth Day, launched in 1970 by Senator Gaylord Nelson of the state of Wisconsin, was designed to draw attention to the environment in an era of incredible social division. Vietnam, civil rights, second wave feminism, the gay and lesbian liberation movement. And in some ways, today, we look at Earth Day tomorrow, we're in a similar situation, but climate change now has shown that many of these problems are on a global scale and that science itself has become political, which is why people are marching to remind us that we need science to provide the information to drive our politics and drive our philosophical discussions.
So did you want to add anything?
Well, I think one of the things we've talked about a lot in our program and I think with our students is that the science is solid science, but I think we haven't maybe thought about the way we translate and how we listen to people's experiences. I think our experience in working with coastal communities is if you listen, the lobstermen see changes and the way they describe and express those are important for us to be able to understand and acknowledge and integrate into the way we understand these systems. So I think it's in part the storytelling of science and how we make it understandable to communities and actionable. I think that's been part of the challenge, and I think that's something we all need to probably learn to do a little bit better.
But it seems that though it's been simplified to, maybe getting beyond what the historical consequences were of our actions or who's to blame, it comes down now to it doesn't exist. It's not happening. It's just it's made up. Why has the debate really come to this very simple, it's happening, it's not happening focus?
Yeah, I think I could speak to that a little bit. I think because, the science behind climate change is fairly complex. It's a very large system, Earth climate system, and has many different components. You have to understand a little bit about each one of these components. Very large data sets, trying to figure out historical records and reconstruct, what's happened on Earth. And, we have a mode of communication in science that's not always, shall we say, readable. Don't always pick up that latest issue of Science, right, and bring it into the living room in the evening by the fire and peruse the latest work in climate change. And so, you know, so the question, really, like a big question is, how do we communicate that to everyone, or the ideas of uncertainty, for example, in science and probability?
And one final thing I'd like to add, and I think it's important for listeners in the audience as well as the broadcast range of MBPN to realize this. There's also been an active decades-long campaign by certain institutions and certain individuals and certain sectors of our economy to actively discredit climate science. The historian of science, Naomi Oreskes, and her colleague, Eric Conway, have written a book that everyone should read called Merchants of Doubt. And it shows the intellectual genealogy. It goes back and shows how the same scientists that dissembled for big tobacco also worked hand in glove to dissemble over climate science. And I think it's telling that there's a pushback against that. Many Fortune 500 companies are asking the White House, they're asking President Donald Trump to not walk away from the Paris Accords because they realize that climate change is real. But a lot of the disinformation, a lot of the sense that there's a debate is partially, like David said, the science is complex. And like Eileen said, we need to communicate it better. But there's also powerful forces that have tried to actively lie.
How much of that disconnect in trying to communicate, scientists trying to communicate with the public, has to do with the 24-hour news cycle as well? Because you're using media now to communicate these stories, but climate change is at such a pace that it's hard to align with a news cycle that demands freshness every 8 to 12 hours. Is that part of it?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's part of it because, you know, you can take a small picture of what's happening with climate change and you're one, you know, your snowstorm, your big snowstorm in the Midwest, oh, the climate's not changing, it's getting colder, your super hot summer on the West Coast. But, you know, the phenomenon's happening on a very large spatial and also a very long temporal scale. So how do you fit that into the 24-hour news cycle or get that understanding?
And do you think that there's really reluctance, though, on the part of the public to accept this? It's very hard to accept that something so, something so important is happening, it could affect our lives. Is that hard for them to accept, and is that part of it?
I think so. There's a survey that was done by Yale University of Maine residents, and it's really shown that there's support for the science. I think if we look en masse at the perceptions and understandings, there's probably more support than not. And I think, again, coming back to people are observing things in their communities. And it's a long timeline. It's over 20 years. 20 years I could do this and now I can't. Ice fishing is different. All of those things that people are starting to understand. So I believe there's a little bit more support for this. I think it's the challenge of how do we move forward on so many fronts where we're seeing these variabilities.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments, the number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical.
Lead paint contaminates many old homes, and programs to deal with it are on the chopping block.
The proposition that we cut EPA funding to states for lead poisoning prevention is very short-sighted and doesn't acknowledge the fact that prevention is where we need to be at this point.
The continuing danger of lead. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Living on Earth, Sunday morning at 7.
Hi, this is Mark Vogelsang, president of Maine Public. During times like this, we know that many of you are counting on public broadcasting more than ever before. You know, listening to public radio and NPR is growing here in Maine and around the country, and more viewers are tuning into Maine Public Television each night for the PBS NewsHour. Every reporter and every host on the air and in our newsroom is dedicated to providing you with the highest level of trusted, independent journalism. We're able to provide this news and information thanks to listener support, a crucial, largest part of our funding picture. And here's where you come in. Join me and take part in our Super Thursday radio campaign on April 27th to keep this NPR station available to everyone. It can be a small gift. It can be a large gift, a first-time gift, or an evergreen friend gift. But no matter how you do it, Your voice is powerful when you go to mainpublic.org and contribute. We'll see you on Super Thursday, April 27.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Maine and its environment. We're broadcasting live from Bowdoin College, and my three guests all have ties to the college. Dave Carlin is an associate professor of biology and director of the Coastal Studies Center. Eileen Johnson is an environmental studies lecturer and program manager. And Matthew Klingel is an associate professor of history and environmental studies and director of the environmental studies program. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And I will take a call in a moment, but we actually have a live questioner here in our audience. And go ahead, please, sir.
Hi, my question is, I hear you describing a complex world that asks us all to deal with questions that are beyond our ken, beyond our experience, beyond perhaps anyone's experience over time. And I think about a K-12 education environment, which is so clearly focused not on dealing with complexities, but rather with getting the right answers. What would you suggest? How do we retool a K-12 public school environment that would prepare not only university students, and I applaud the great work going on here at Bowdoin and other Maine institutions and around the globe, but how do we do it at K-12? How do we get kids ready to come in large numbers to take full advantage of the opportunities here?
Matt? As a former high school teacher and someone who's worked closely with K-12 schools, both when I lived in Seattle and the Bay Area previously, now here in Maine, I would only push back slightly to say, at least with my children's experience here in the Brunswick Public Schools, that they do problem-based, site-based, research-driven curriculum. They work closely with a variety of organizations, such as the Catharines River Environmental Organization over in Topsom. They work here with the Brunswick Topsom Land Trust. And I think that you're right that there is challenges in the K-12 curriculum. I knew this when I taught high school longer ago than I'd like to remember right now. But I also think that on the local level, at least here in Maine, what I've seen in the schools here in Brunswick, is I think there's a real attention to getting students to think about complexity. As a historian, I'm in the complexity business. And I think one simple way that if I could reform K-12 education would be to make sure that we focus more on problems and questions and less on testing and assessment. But that's a larger critique in education that's a bit beyond my ken.
Are you finding, though, that the students that are coming into Bowdoin that you're teaching, are they coming in prepared with the foundations to study environmental studies?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think that sort of following up on your question, that there are some fundamentals students need to communicate well, they need to be critical consumers of data. Increasingly, we need to teach students that. And I think they need to be comfortable doing group work, because the way we're going to resolve some of these issues is we need to get humanists and economists and ecologists in the room together. And so if a student's strength is the sciences, we want to pull them a bit out of that comfort zone and say, great, but can you write about that really well? And I also want to point to some great examples that are starting to happen here in Maine. The Gulf of Maine Research Institute has a curriculum, C-RISE, that's really focused on working with the city of Portland and South Portland schools, I believe, and trying to integrate this as part of that. So those are really promising examples as well.
Yeah, and I can add one more point, and that is, I think, there's a big emphasis at the college level right now to really get students introduced to problems, have them actually, science by learning by doing. And to understand the process of science, there's an answer. Is it right or wrong? Well, it's an answer. And can you get the answer? And even formulating the question, what's a really good question? And why don't we just scale that down to K-12 and push it in the scientific classrooms at that level as well? It's harder. It's more challenging. You're bringing students on big field trips sometimes. But, why not focus on that style of learning rather than just as well as the factual material?
It's a great question.
Thank you. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation by phone. Let's go to Paul in Belmont. Hi, Paul. Let's see. Do we have Paul? No. I'm going to Let's see. I'm going to try it now.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. There you go, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm in my 60s, and I've been involved in the environmental movement and organic farming for about 40 plus years now, since high school days. And you know, I moved to Maine in my early 20s, and we as a society in Maine have a definite in contact and interest in the environment, all of us pretty much. I just returned from a four-month trip from the West Coast in Mexico across the south of the country, and something became very, very clear to me that my brother had mentioned a number of years ago, which is the high school education, graduation, and the quality of that education across the heartland of this country is very inferior compared to California, Washington, Oregon, and the East Coast, Connecticut, where I'm from, all the way up to Maine. And the current debate about science and climate change, I think, has a lot to do with the ability of adult people to actually comprehend the science, but also to like go out of a system where their belief system is a very, very different belief system, a world that other sources are as important or maybe even more important than what we know as science and education. And so my question is, how do we talk to the rest of the country? How do we get out of our, excuse the phrase, ivory towers and sophistication around a science-based world to talk to people who have a religious-based world and a very old-fashioned sort of country parochial kind of world?
Thank you. Anyway, it's a big question,
yeah.
Not only for environmental issues, but other issues as well.
Well, I grew up in flyover country. I grew up in one of those square states that's always on the maps seen red, namely Utah. And I had family that worked in Wyoming, that worked in the petroleum business, that worked in the ranching business. And I would say that I think one thing, going back to what Eileen mentioned earlier, is how we communicate. You may not be able to communicate around the details about atmospheric carbon and the anthropogenic or human-driven factors beyond that. But you can ask, why is it there are more wildfires on your rangelands? Why is it that you're seeing invasive species that are girdling trees, basically eating away the bark and causing the trees to die, that are increasing as a result of climate change? I also think that it would be a mistake to say that you cannot have a religious outlook and a scientific outlook. The late, great popularizer of science, as well as a great evolutionary biologist himself, Stephen Jay Gould, commented that you can have faith and also believe in science. And a variety of religious organizations, from the American Council for Catholic Bishops to a variety of evangelical groups, have long been at the forefront of environmental justice and environmental advocacy issues, from saving the salmon along the Columbia River Basin to advocating for better management of the waters of the Colorado River Basin. And many of them are beginning to support issues surrounding climate change and issues of environmental justice and equity. So I would say that it's how we frame it, it's how we discuss it, and we find a position of shared values. And I think there's a lot more that unites us in this country than that divides us when it comes to questions of the environment.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
I'm covered by the previous caller's question.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Let's go to Cameron in Bangor. Hi, Cameron. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead, please.
Well, I am I'm working with a bit of a conflict in my family. I'm a college-educated graduate with a degree in environmental sciences, and both of my siblings are also college-educated and very science-minded. We have two parents who are also college-educated and very involved in politics and big consumers of conservative media. It has been very difficult for my siblings and I to get across to them that climate change as a whole is not fabricated or a scam to get environmental and scientific groups more funding. And they sort of claim that a lot of the evidence that I bring to the table as more of a field biologist is anecdotal rather than, you know, broad-reaching and more impactful on the environment as a whole. And I was wondering if you have any tools or advice to not come across as condescending to people that you have great respect for, but really don't have as solid a grasp on what this science means and says about our world.
So I guess I'd ask, do you talk to your parents about the weather?
I do, yes.
Because almost almost anywhere you go now, it seems like, you know, there's a recognition that weather patterns, you know, are changing. I guess mm-hmm. the other question is, why are those weather patterns changing? But it's kind of hard to avoid almost anywhere in the United States. So
yeah, weather isn't small talk anymore.
yeah, right. Put weather on the table, and so.
Yeah. Well, it's I guess more of the same. The same big question that we may not answer today. Let's go to Tammy in Charleston. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you.
Just a couple of things. Climate change, for myself in the beginning, you know, I was a busy mom, and it was a huge change. And I have to tell you, I felt, like, helpless and overwhelmed. And then I began to realize that climate change and pollution, they're not really a problem, but rather kind of a symptom or a consequence of our lifestyles and the way we perceive things. And I thought, I can't make the government or corporations or even my neighbors make choices that I might advocate. But what I can do, you know, because with them it would be like moving a mountain. But I can take responsibility for me, and I can make lifestyle changes within my sphere. And the nice thing about it was it kind of put the control back in my hands, and it made the steps small and easier to take. So for me, getting rid of the big picture and just working on the little things one step at a time has made it something that I can handle, and I just thought that that might be useful to people. As regards religion, I've never had a problem with that. I figured if God created the heavens and the earth, wouldn't it be respectful to care for something that you've been given? So anyway, those are just some thoughts.
All right, Tammy, thank you very much. As she was talking, I was thinking, is it fair to ask scientists, researchers who are busy using the scientific method to collect data, to interpret it, to also be advocates, to be public spokespeople, to lead movements in terms of political change? Is that something that's been thrust upon scientists who heretofore were busy doing their good work?
Well, I think one thing is that there's probably a space for doing continued good science, but also just being available and willing to provide information and disseminate in ways that's understandable, to come and speak to more groups, to maybe serve on advisory capacity to for boards that are working on policy, but you can inform that policy making, to be more engaged. And I think that's one of the things that we really work with our students on. We have future leaders, scientists, and we want to show them pathways to do the good science, but then go out and communicate it to a general public and be ready to hear the sorts of things they know in some ways better than you do. And so I think that that's an important thing for scientists, for all of us to keep in mind.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
Yeah. It's pretty much related to what you're talking about, but as a college student who has kind of been educated in this environment of looking at complexity and looking at the interconnectedness of climate change, it kind of becomes this large, unmanageable thing. And I'm kind of curious what you all see as the best ways to take that interconnectedness, because if as a world we kind of can't agree whether or not to even do anything or how to do anything about climate change, and it has so much momentum and there's so many different projections of where our planet on the local and on the earth-wide scale are headed, kind of how do you come out of an institution like Bowdoin or kind of step into this field and address the whole issue as a whole? Because while individual action helps, it can't change the entire system.
Well, right. So one exercise, I guess you could call it, that that I found very illuminating in a number of ways. This is something we do in my Understanding Climate Change class here on campus. I don't know if any of my students are here. And they just did a project where they calculate their my carbon footprint. And they figure out, you know, how much carbon they're emitting and how that relates to folks in other countries, or even how that relates to living in another city. And then I ask them to do an experiment where, okay, change your lifestyle. You've graduated from college. You might be making more money. You know, what's your carbon footprint now? So even just breaking down and understanding, you know, what the pieces are of that and how they're contributing to something that's obviously a global problem might make you start to think, well, you know, how could we change that footprint, scale it up from a single person to a broader scale.
And Natalie, if I could, I'm going to out you since I know who you are. The other thing I would add to what Dave just said is I'd also add that collective action has been shown to work historically. Collective action has been shown to create large-scale changes of very complicated issues. Take, for example, the issue of race. We are not in a post-racial society, but people marched, protested, died so that we could have a more inclusive society. The problem's still there, but have we made progress? I would argue that we have, even if that progress is incomplete. And I also want to respond back to the earlier caller. Science has always been political. In the wake of the atomic weapons revolution, the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, scientists got together and founded a publication called the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. You have people like Rachel Carson who took science, popularized it, and raised questions about chemicals in our environment. And so I'd say it's not a question of whether science and politics should not coexist. They should. It's the question of to what degree do you do good research, subject it to peer review, put it in the audience of public opinion, and then have those spirited debates. I think, if anything, scientists have to be involved in these debates, and to not be involved is perilous in these times.
And I can add one more thing to that, Matt, that's just intriguing, in that it appears in the United States that in our civil life and in public government, we have the lowest fraction of PhD scientists that actually choose to go into public service. Yet in other countries, South America and Europe, you know, there are PhD scientists that are in the government and are holding government positions. So seems I'm not sure why that is or why it has to be, but it would change, I think, the public discussion.
And that's a great point, because the American Academy for the Advancement of Science has now been doing these postdoctoral fellowships just to address that very issue and get people out there that maybe want to do science but want to contribute to the public good.
All right, we'll take another quick break. When we come back, we want to hear more from you. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does WEX, providing global payment solutions for the fleet, travel, and health industries. Career opportunities at WEXINC.com.
Another story of widespread sexual assault by faculty and an elite New England boarding school came after an internal investigation.
They began these investigations so that they could say they were doing due diligence. And then they lifted up this rock, and there were all kinds of things crawling underneath there.
On Next, we'll talk about the Boston Globe Spotlight report that prompted that closer look. Join us for Next from the New England News Collaborative.
And you can hear Next coming up after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock.
The power of ideas and information and news on Maine Public Radio has the power to bring you close and also take you far away. This unique opportunity to engage with the world through the wonder of radio is made possible only with your contribution. And today, I'm asking you to keep Maine Public Radio close by making a donation in support of the voices that add so much to your life. When you donate today, your voice and your support are heard loud and clear and will count towards the upcoming Super Thursday one-day pledge drive. Please call or go online to mainepublic.org right now, and thank you.
Super Thursday is April 27th, but you can contribute right now at mainepublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475. Thanks.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling, broadcasting live from Smith Auditorium at Bowdoin College. Today on the program, Maine as a laboratory for a changing environment. With me today, three people who work here at Bowdoin and are involved in environmental studies. Matthew Klingel, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies and Director of the Environmental Studies Program. Dave Carlin is an Associate Professor of Biology and Director of the Coastal Studies Center. And Eileen Johnson is an Environmental Studies Lecturer and Program Manager. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. We'll go back to the phones and to our audience questions, but I wonder if we could start off by talking a little bit about what students that are coming from Bowdoin are doing in communities, working in communities around this issue.
Well, I think one of the things we do is we provide a range of opportunities for students to engage through summer work, working directly with organizations, and understanding the ways in which these issues intersect with issues of environmental justice, issues of environmental food security. And then we support students through community-based work. All the courses I teach have a community-based component. And I encourage students to go out into the community. I encourage community members to come in and talk with students and give them feedback. And then we also support a lot of undergraduate research that is often done in partnership with nonprofit organizations. Again, back to my point of that we're very fortunate in Maine to have a lot of organizations that are doing stellar work around these fields. And we're only going to solve this if we all kind of get together and work collaboratively. And we want to model that for our students.
Okay. Since 2000, we've had over 140 students placed with almost 30 separate agencies and organizations and local governments in the state of Maine during their time at Bowdoin. And they've worked everywhere from the town of Brunswick to Coastal Enterprises Incorporated, so private public sectors. And so when they graduate, not unlike graduates of other schools, they work the entire gamut from academia, from the public sector to the private sector. And we really try to pride ourselves on trying to train our students, you know, going back to Natalie's early question about training them to think about things through complexity, that they can approach the environment from any professional sector, that they don't have to go into a particular sector and think that they're doing good. They can do good from the private sector, the public sector, anywhere.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
I do have a question. My name is Lisa. I'm from Harpswell. And this is more a national level question, but now that you've seen Scott Pruitt's leadership of the EPA, can you give us your impressions and maybe project a little into the future in terms of what we can realistically expect?
This is Matt. I'll take a quick stab at it. We've been here before. Ann Gersuch Burford, whose son is now the new Supreme Court Justice, was the EPA director for two tumultuous years in the first part of the Reagan administration. James Gaius Watt was director of the Interior. Ann Gersuch Burford's husband was director of the Bureau of Land Management. The EPA survived, the BLM survived, the Department of Interior survived. It's not to say that there are not going to be perilous times if you are for the environment, but I would also say that Pruitt already is walking back some of the hardline positions that he said he took regarding climate change. He is not saying we should pull out of the Paris Accords, and you're having very powerful people that ties to Washington, many Fortune 500 companies that are exerting their influence. So I'd also say that I think it's important that the nomination of Scott Pruitt in this past election should also be a reminder that if we're talking about the environment, there are communities in this country, from the coal belt of Kentucky to the high windswept prairies of the Dakotas with the fracking center of the petroleum industry, that have not been listened to. And it doesn't mean that everyone should agree with them, but we should keep in mind that Ryan Zinke, who is the head of Interior, is an ardent conservationist. He is a big supporter of pollution controls, and he controls the single largest system of land management in all of North America. So I think that we need to be prudent if we want to oppose Pruitt, but I also think we need to be open for realizing that politics of pragmatism means that the EPA is not going to be eliminated. We're just going to have to be very vigilant if the environment is your cause.
Email from Todd, at the risk of sounding like a Debbie Downer, isn't the only realistic way of halting or reversing climate change to immediately stop all manufacturing, transportation, and the creation of energy worldwide? Has the horse already left the barn?
Well, I'll disagree the horse is running, but well, the horse is about to run out of the barn. But there are things that we can do with existing technology that just involve essentially cutting back emissions in a fairly big way. And it doesn't require necessarily new technical carbon capture, for example, to make that happen. But you know, efficiency of automobiles, cleaner burning coal. These are all more alternative energy. These are all technologies and initiatives that, that governments can choose to go down and essentially slow that change. I mean, the goal is to hold the global temperature to 2 degrees Celsius from the Paris Agreement. That's an ambitious goal, and it's going to take big cuts, but I would say it is possible.
Let's go to Ellery in Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate this excellent program. I have a quick comment and a question. My comment is I think there will be reputable scientists when the Earth is totally engulfed in a greenhouse gas effect, and they will still be waiting for the last bit of data to come through before they admit it. My question is, I'm seeing references to extinctions, and I was wondering if Maine, if you're in your groups of studies, have you come across any extinctions yet, microbiota perhaps, or something, the shrimp fishery is of great concern right now.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, and I'm certainly no specialist in every area of biology, I guess, thank goodness. But, you know, you can look at things like, is there local extinction? Yes, things are moving out, for example, the Gulf of Maine to other places like Canada. So we don't have them here regionally. But a lot of the plants and animals that occur here in Maine, both in the water and on land, are pretty broadly distributed in New England and North America. So we're probably not going to see a lot of things go extinct during this next, say, 20 or 50 years.
Just a couple of minutes left, literally. If you have one last question, quickly, go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Laura Sewell, and I'm very interested in how Maine can be a living laboratory for us understanding more about climate changes and other rapid environmental changes.
Okay, it's great to see you, Laura, and I feel that you want me to tell the folks about a network, actually, that Laura and I work on called...
that and also the Gulf of Maine warming so fast.
Right, so one of the things that we're doing here at Bowdoin is we're teaming up with Bates and a bunch of other institutions like the Gulf of Maine Research Institute and Bigelow and Darling Center to actually get some measurements of temperature as well as understand how biological systems are changing on a Gulf of Maine scale. If you look at all of our sites, it really rings the Gulf of Maine. So that's one thing I think we're doing on a community level that's been really great, and it involves both smaller colleges like Bowdoin and Bates as well as these bigger institutions. And I'm glad you stepped forward. That's great.
About a minute left. Are there any opportunities for the general public to take part in any of the work that you're doing or in the communities that the students are touching?
Well, I think one of the areas that we talk a lot about is the role of citizen science, the role of organizations, the water quality monitoring that happens. Some of the water quality monitoring is Friends of Casco Bay, and they have this tremendous program of training volunteers. It could be we're working with a project looking at bumblebees, and there's a bumblebee atlas to sort of measure changes in distribution. So if your passion is ecology, there's opportunities. Certainly, we talk a lot about local level governance and the ways that having good conservation commissions engaged in these processes. And I see in our audience a number of people I've worked with personally who are playing important roles. I think find your passion, get involved, and we love to work with people like that in the communities.
And I would say that it runs the whole gamut of what we teach here at Bowdoin. If you're someone who may not necessarily feel comfortable in the sciences and going out and working with Friends of Casco Bay doing water monitoring, participate with your local land trust. Go to the farmer's market, meet the people who are growing your food, who are raising your vegetables and your fruit. Aldo Leopold once wrote in his famed essay, The Land Ethic, that we can only care for those places that we know and love. So I'd argue even a simple act of going outside and appreciating the natural world and then making connections with people in the community, people who may think very differently than you, someone who may have voted differently on the bear baiting referendum or voted differently on gun control, but still has a passion for the environment, has a passion for the state we live in. Those are the ways in which I think we can make tangible differences and make Maine continue to be the laboratory for studying the environment that it is.
Eileen, Dave, Matt, thank you very much for joining us today. And thanks to our host, Bowdoin College, and to all of those who showed up here in the auditorium. Eileen Johnson is an environmental studies lecturer and environmental studies program manager here at Bowdoin. Dave Carlin is associate professor of biology and director of the Coastal Studies Center at Bowdoin. And Matthew Klingel is an associate professor of history and environmental studies and director of the environmental studies program also here at Bowdoin College. John Keimel ran the board today. We had technical help from Dan Works and John Bradford. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.